I'd like to call the meeting of House Committee on Rules to order for Thursday, June 6th, and want to open a public hearing on House Bill 3530, and like to call up Representative Benz and Representative Clem, please.
And members of the committee, House Bill 3530 makes revocation or modification of order issued for split-use water lease mandatory if in-stream use of water under lease has resulted in injury to existing water right. This measure has no revenue impact. I do not have a fiscal impact yet. It does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay.
Hello, Madam Vice or Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Brian Clem, State Representative from District 21 here in Salem, here to appear in support of House Bill 3530, which I'll remind you, you are a chief co-sponsor of, and I'm over in the second position. I don't know how that happened, but okay. Now, this is a very quick topic. We had a bill, came across the floor. There was some consternation. We're resolving the consternation here through this bill by changing the word shall to may. No, may to shall. And it
makes a difference.
Really, it's not good so far. The departments here, this largely codifies what their current practice was, but it'll make a lot of people feel a lot better to have this bill as a modification to Senate Bill 199 in place. And my good co-sponsor here could probably talk more in detail, but I'm sure you have an agenda, so I don't know how much you want to go into that or not.
Thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Cliff Benz, District 60, appearing in support of the bill, and I want to thank the committee for hearing the bill. It's a modest bill, but it makes a lot of difference for those who might be harmed by a water lease, and it's not as broad as I would like, but on the other hand, it's much better than what we had, so I'm very much supportive of the bill, and probably not much more to say than that.
Well, thank you. We're waiting on paperwork for this bill, and once we get it, we will move this down to Ways and Means. Thank you for bringing forward this modest proposal.
Will you vote yes, Madam Chair?
Of course.
Oh, thank you.
Of course.
Question.
Committed in public. Question from the committee.
I noticed some down there first.
So, what does it do?
Changes may to shall or
changes
shall
may
to may.
Shall,
Madam Chair, the Vice Chair took the words out of my mouth.
So, Madam Vice Chair, Vice Chair Hicks, excuse me. The may to shall has to do with if there's going to be an injury to an existing water right holder before there's one other modification, I should say. It takes out the words or may result in injury. So, for example, there is a lease in the program that has been determined by the department that it has resulted in an injury to the more junior water right holder. This changes the may revoke or modify an order issued for a lease to shall revoke. So when the injury occurs, it's deemed there's been an injury, it's no longer discretionary whether they're going to revoke the order. They will revoke the order.
Okay.
If that helps.
It does.
Any other questions or comments from the committee? Yes, Representative.
Thank you. It turns out I do have another question.
Hmm.
I probably misunderstand the water laws here. So let me just describe the situation that I'm thinking about and tell me. You can tell me I'm all wet or whatever.
Oh no!
Don't waste the water.
A junior water right by definition is subject to being injured in the sense that he can't use water. If there's not enough water after the senior water right user has used water. If I understand what this bill does, in effect, what it says is if there's not enough water for both senior and junior water right, the lease in this situation has to give way to the interest of the junior. Have I understood that correctly?
Not quite,
yeah.
But I'm sure. Well,
that's why I asked the question.
And he was on Water Resources Commission for 8 years.
The language reads injury to an existing water right. And so either a prior water right or a junior water right could be harmed by a lease of some other water right, because the lease of the water right can be the paper right, which let's say is 4 CFS, as opposed to the amount of water that actually is consumed, which might be far less. If you keep the 4 CFS in the stream under the lease, well, in this case, it's a split season, so let's assume you use 2 of the 4 out of stream and say, I'm going to leave 2 in. But let's assume that when it was originally being used, only 3 was being diverted. What just happened is you've expanded the use of the right by 1 CFS, the real use of it. Mm-hmm. If this had been limited to a measure of the consumed use, that'd be one thing. Under the original 4 acre feet, maybe only 2 or 3 were used, or maybe part of the right ran back into the river or into the stream after it was used. Mm-hmm. Now that and it would then be available, having been diverted and back in the stream, it becomes available for the next water user, but not under a lease. The lease, the idea is you leave it in the river and protect it as it goes downstream. So if someone downstream says, hey, what the heck, they're busy protecting 4 CFS past my point of diversion, that's not right, because in the past I could always divert the water that ran back in after my neighbor had used it, then indeed they have injury. And when I posed this on the floor, I was pointing out that the way this is crafted, it flips the burden of proof to the poor person to come in and prove injury. And so that's one of the things that's not changed by this, but I'm okay with that. There was still a no requirement that even if you proved injury the way the bill was written, that the department had to do anything about it. Said it may change, may do something. And so I said, hey, why don't we change that to shall? Because if you prove injury, for goodness sakes, let's get protection. So now we have it if this bill passes.
Just a quick follow-up. So if I understand, at least some of those examples you gave are ones in which the senior user would probably have at least technically lost part of the water right because of non-use. And obviously, in other cases where the water ran back into the stream, he would he'd keep it. So, is this partly a way of adjusting for the reality that that it's virtually impossible to actually know when a right has been extinguished by non-use or has been reduced by non-use? Is that part of the issue?
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, it really isn't, but the forfeiture of a water right is an entirely different situation.
Right.
In the normal course, if you have a water right for 4 CFS and you use only 3, it's A, generally very, very difficult to prove, and B, it doesn't mean you forfeited your right. You don't have to use every bit of your right every year.
Mm-hmm.
You merely need to use most of it most of the time, and then that usually will get you past any argument that you've somehow forfeited your right.
Right.
But that's a different argument. The better approach here would probably be to say, gosh, how are we ever going to know unless there's measurement? And in many of these cases, there isn't.
Right.
So that's another one of the problems with this type of an arrangement, if there isn't a measured system.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I asked the question in a clumsy way, but I think I got the answer that I was expecting. Thank you.
Any further questions?
I hope not. Oh, sorry. Did I say that out loud?
They wouldn't be for you.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you both.
Thank you.
We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3530. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3389. Representative Conger.
And members of the committee, House Bill 3389, we have an amendment that replaces the original measure. The -4 amendment addresses short sales. Section 2 addresses short sales when they are negotiated as alternatives to foreclosure between beneficiary and nonprofit purchaser. Prohibits beneficiary from requiring nonprofit purchaser at short sale to sign arm's length affidavit promising not to sell or rent back to original owner of home. Creates exceptions to allow beneficiary to continue requiring these affidavits if they had not gotten adequate notice of the nonprofit's intention ahead of time, if homeowner does not cooperate with the appraisal process, or if lender's contractual other legal obligation requires lender to have these affidavits. Section 3 changes definition of term of residential trust deed. Section 4 clarifies that lender's certificate of compliance that must be filed prior to non-judicial foreclosure must be unexpired at time of recording of notice of default. It need not be unexpired for entire length of the proceeding, just when proceeding begins.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jason Conger representing House District 54, and very much appreciate the opportunity to come in and describe a little bit of the -4 amendments and also give you a brief sense of what the program is that we're dealing with here in this amendment and why. I also want to point out, I just came from room 50 where I was up in front of three classes, so about 120 fifth graders from Lava Ridge Elementary School. So as August as his body is, I feel a lot safer here than I did in front of those kids. So the program, let me start with the program quickly to give you a 30-second overview. It's called the Loan Refinance Assistance Pilot Project, or LRAP, which is a lot easier to say. It is intended to help homeowners who are facing foreclosure engage in a short sale process that actually allows the homeowner to stay in the home. An example I actually have, so the pilot project has been in Deschutes County now for a little while. I'm going to give you some statistics, which I think are incredibly impressive from just what the pilot program has done so far. But to give you an example of what this means, I have a retired military friend who is in his mid-70s and came to me and said, we had an adjustable rate mortgage, can't get it refinanced because our house is underwater and we are not going to be able to continue to afford the payments when the rate adjusts. This is a gentleman who has served his country. He is very ethical, and he's not in a position financially to be able to move around a lot, and not in a position financially on a fixed income to be able to afford a higher cost for his home. And of course, the problem comes down to can't refinance because the home is underwater. What we're dealing with, of course, is the negative equity that exists in a lot of communities in the residential market. And that he would be an ideal candidate for this program. If he could be the buyer in a normal short sale of his home, he would be fine. If he could negotiate with the bank to restructure his loan, he would be fine. But many people find that trying to negotiate or restructure the loan is impossible. And so the LRAP program puts a third party, which is a revolving loan fund, essentially, funded by the state, in the position of the buyer in the short sale with the bank, and allows the loan program then to essentially enter into a lender position with the homeowner at the lower value with a restructured loan. Hopefully that makes sense, but obviously I and the folks who will be on the panels behind me are happy to answer any questions if it doesn't make sense. The problem, of course, again, is trying to overcome the difficulty of renegotiating loans with the bank as a homeowner really before you're in default. Most often, I think these folks know they're going to not be able to continue to afford their mortgage, and they don't want to go into default for all the obvious reasons. So, the amendment is actually really simple. It's trying to get at the tendency of the lender to try to avoid situations where the homeowner who is headed into default or is already in default ends up being ultimately the buyer in the short sale, but for the wrong reasons. And so there are some moral hazards, I think, associated with people buying their own home in short sales or using straw men to do that. That's not what this program does. And so the amendment is really focused on trying to get at that contract clause that would say the grantor in the trust deed can't be occupy the property after the short sale. These are contract provisions that sometimes do exist, and again, I think the panels that follow me will talk specifically about what that means. But the idea is to get those things out where you're dealing with this program, which has a legitimate third-party buyer, is a specifically targeted program, and is doing good things. So with that, let me just close by citing a couple of statistics. 78 loans have been closed in the LRAP program. And again, remember, this is just a small pilot in Central Oregon. Average principal reduction on the mortgages of the loans that were closed was $103,000. $10 million, rounded number, has been invested by the program. The lender received 90 lenders, meaning the short sale lender, the original lender, received 90% of current value, which is probably more than would have been realized through foreclosure in most cases. The first $6.3 million in loans have been sold to a local bank and the money recaptured to be revolved and used again. This is a revolving loan program. So as the loans are paid back or sold, the money comes back in, and that means you can make more loans and help more people who are struggling stay in their homes through the program. All of the government funds have been recaptured, will be recaptured, and a small profit will actually be returned to the state. The program is replicable and scalable to any community that has substantial negative equity. All administrative costs are paid by the transaction, so there's actually no administrative cost to the state. Homeowners repay the state for the full cost of the program with a slight markup because there is risk of a default and further negative equity. So we have to price that in. But the program is working even with that. And the repayment rate in the first year is far ahead of industry averages because the people are already in their home and they're being fully underwritten. So these are fully underwritten loans at the new value and with the new terms. And I guess just one other thing to add, and that would be that I think it's possible that this program could be introduced by the loan counselors, the counseling and mediation process that we have worked on over a couple of sessions as an alternative to default and foreclosure. And I'd be happy to answer any questions if I haven't completely covered every detail of this program.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I may have missed it. How do they handle servicing of the loan?
I believe the servicing is done by the program, but I think that would be a good question for the Housing and Community Development,
okay,
who will follow me to confirm that. But I believe it's done in-house unless the loan is then sold. And I think, I'm not positive, but I think for the portfolio of loans, the $6.3 million that have been sold to a bank, I think the servicing goes with that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great. Thank you, Representative. We'll hear from our next panel.
Thank you very much.
Paul Cosgrove, Sean Miller, Margaret Van Vliet, please.
It's up.
That was quick.
Yeah.
Sean is not going
to be on the wrong bill.
Mr. Chair, just briefly as an introduction, Paul Cosgrove representing the Oregon Bankers, the Independent Community Banks of Oregon, and the Oregon Financial Service Association. We worked with the program that Representative Conger has described to get to the language that's in Section 2 of the bill, which he described in Ben Bleak and give you more details. Okay. I will take a moment to describe the issue covered by Section 3 of the bill, and then Mr. Miller will describe the issue, describe it in Section 4 of the bill. All of them are either matters that we support or are neutral on, but we believe that there is no controversy with respect to any of them at this point. We've worked hard to try to reach that point.
Chair Garrett and members of the committee, my name is Margaret Van Vliet. I'm the Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. My agency is responsible for administering this program, this LRAP program, so I'm just going to give you a very high-level sort of overview of this program and where it fits in the context of our other work. This is one piece of what came to the state a few years ago from the U.S. Department of Treasury as a foreclosure mitigation tool. We were lucky enough to be one of 19 hardest hit states, and Oregon received $220 million to work on foreclosure avoidance. We've been hard at work at that. We got off to a bumpy start, but the program is operating very well now. So of that big $220 million allocation that came to us, we carved out $10 million to do this LRAP program in Deschutes and Jackson County, as Representative Conger mentioned, and have been working hard to develop a mechanism to make this work for underwater borrowers. And so you've heard the success statistics, and I think you have a report in front of you. A couple of things I would highlight as to the servicing question. So back up one second. We actually use this Treasury money, this hardest hit money, and that's the source of funds that we make the loans with. So that's the state state fund, the state resource that funds the loans. Because we have a very large portfolio of mortgage loans, we have servicing arrangements with a variety of private sector servicing companies, and one company we have chosen does this work, does that servicing work for us. We have a contractor, which is the Further Development Company, run by Eric Sten, and he is here today as well if there are questions that I cannot answer. And so it is not our own staff that do the heavy lifting on the ground working with the borrowers, although we do have underwriting staff on tap that that do some of the underwriting and analysis work. So we're really excited that we were able to sell these loans. We are the first state in the nation under this program to create a conforming loan product that then was marketable in the secondary market, if you will. So the idea that we can revolve this a few times and serve more homeowners is very exciting to us. And the other thing I'll mention is, before I turn it back over to Paul, is that we recently expanded the pilot to Crook, Jefferson, and Josephine counties. We want to keep an eye on sort of what the underwater, the market for potential homeowners for whom this would be a good fit is in those additional counties. So, thank you.
Thank you.
John? First, or just numerically, Mr. Chair, Paul Cosgrove again. Section 2 of the bill deals with an issue that Representative Hovey may recall came up in a hearing on a prior bill, and that is in Oregon's trust deed statute, the definition of residential trust deed has been changed in prior sessions to one that's relatively problematic, and we've negotiated a resolution of that problem, and that's what's in Section 2 of the bill. You would think a definition of residential trust deed would be pretty obvious, but in Oregon, it's always had two factors. One is, what is the property? And that's easy, 1 to 4 units of residence, 4 residents, so a fourplex, a threeplex, a duplex, or a single-family home. Those are all residential property. The confounding part is, it also, the definition depends on who's residing in it at a particular time. And in Oregon, it's residential if it is the primary residence of the grantor's spouse, or the grantor's dependent or disabled child. And so we have to know not only what the property is, but who's in it at the right time. What we have come to an agreement is the best time to make that measurement and to determine whether a property is the trustee and the loan is a residential trustee is at the time the loan is made. As you may recall, when you've had home loans, generally speaking, one of the major underwriting things that the financial institution does is finds out, is this a primary residence of the occupant? That's part of the underwriting of the loan. Same if a property is being refinanced, the rates are different, the underwriting is different if it's a primary residence or some other kind of investment or vacation property. So what this bill does is it changes the definition of residential trustee going forward so that it means it is 1 to 4 units, that is the resident primary residence of the grantor spouse or disabled or minor child at the time the loan is made. And that's the simple description of Section 2.
Thank you. I was just going to correct Mr. Cosgrove that it was in Section 3 because he kept saying Section 2 all along the definition. And I do appreciate, I did try to point him to this particular bill earlier as he was trying to amend a different bill that we didn't really want to amend to his chagrin. So I appreciate him continuing to work on this. And it was, and the reason that the committee this bill came from was the committee that I chair, and I had heard of the situation with Eric Sten and the program they had there, and they needed statutory changes so that they could actually use short sales as part of those programs. And I believe the federal government also has some say-so, has some limitations about what they can do with their federal funds that this bill in Section 2 helps change. So that's almost the extent of my knowledge of it so far. So just thought I would give that a little bit of feedback to
this.
So.
Any other questions or comments for the panel?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I'm here today on behalf of the United Trustees Association, which are those acting as trustees under the Real Property Deeds of Trust. And the issue that we're trying to address in Section 4 was also a clarification in Senate Bill 558, which expands the mandatory mediation program. And the clarification we're seeking to is just mirroring the intent of the advocates and the Attorney General intent, but the language in Senate Bill 558 was not clear. And what we're trying to simply say is that an unexpired certificate of compliance is only needed at the time of filing, not through the entire foreclosure process. And so the current language could be interpreted to require that the certificate of compliance be current through the entire process, which could take more than a year. And so that was impractical. So again, I know this bill, Senate Bill 558, also went through Representative Holby's policy committee, and so we're back just to clarify this language. We did provide this language to Sybil Hebb, the Oregon Law Center, who ran this by the advocates of Senate Bill 558, and the language reflected in the Dash 4 amendments is agreed upon language through all the parties. And so, again, it's just a clarification. I appreciate it, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you all. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are we in church?
We don't have paperwork. Okay. We'll go ahead and close the public hearing.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 3389. We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 724. Ms. Sauer?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 724 came to this committee off the floor yesterday to make an amendment. It is the Dash B9 amendment, which allows insurers to pay ambulatory surgical centers, or ASCs, directly or to patient with dual-issue check. The measure as coming off the floor requires Oregon Health Authority develop account method for innovative non-traditional services by August 1, 2013, directs OHA or Department of Human Services provide coordinated care organizations, CCOs, statement of their costs when transferring those service responsibilities to CCOs. If CCOs assume cost of service, OHA or DHS shall report to Legislative Assembly no later than February of the following year. Requires payment from insurers to patients for treatment provided by ASCs be made out jointly to patient and ASC effective date January 1, 2014. We have a minimal fiscal impact on the Dash B9 amendment, and we have no revenue impact on the Dash B9 amendment. Greg Miller is here if you have any questions.
Does he need to speak to
me? He doesn't have to unless you have any questions.
You're right. So
there's this one.
That's fine.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the B9 amendment to Senate Bill 724.
Vice Chair Hicks moves the B9 amendment to Senate Bill 724. Is there any discussion?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm kind of trying to engross this thing in my head. Could we take just a moment to do that?
Sure.
Thank you.
All the time you need.
I'm finished and I'm happy. Thank you.
As long as you're happy. Representative Hicks has moved the Dash B9 amendment. Is there any discussion of the amendment? Any objection? Hearing none. So ordered. The amendment is adopted.
And Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 724 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hicks moves Senate Bill 724 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? None. So ordered. And Representative Klein will carry that bill. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 724. Open a work session on Senate Bill 496.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 496 was heard on Monday, June 3rd. The measure requires monies in county road fund expended for patrolling to be used for direct and indirect patrolling costs, defines direct costs to include salaries, travel, equipment, and supplies directly related to county law enforcement patrolling, defines indirect costs to include costs incurred for common or joint objectives, including costs of operating and maintaining facilities, depreciation, administrative expenses, and dispatch. defines patrolling to mean activities of county law enforcement official in response to calls for service or initiated by official, applies to monies received by county before, on, or after effective date of this act, repeals act on January 2nd, 2016, and there is an emergency clause on the measure.
Colleagues, it's part of our suite of county fiscal bills, not one of the ones that needed amendments, so we're ready to move it.
So, Mr. Kyle, are you prepared to take a quick question? I hate to put you on the spot. So, from what I gather, there was an interpretation issue regarding patrolling. Is that accurate?
Chairman Garrett and Representative Hicks, all the bill is trying to do is memorialize what we think the intent always was that embedded in the cost of having a deputy out on patrol is these costs that include some administrative overhead, cost of dispatch. It's not simply the hourly rate of the individual in the vehicle.
Thank you. And then can you tell us your name for the sake of...
Sorry. Excuse me. I'm Alex Kyler, Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager.
Thanks. So I just, if there had been an interpretation issue, we want to make sure this would nail it down, but it sounds like this is going to get there. In terms of implementation, thanks. Okay, and then, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Revenue Committee dealt with this issue a couple of different times. And it's very clear to me that the intent of the original law that allowed for these things to happen is fulfilled in this bill.
Yeah, I know. I remember testifying a couple times in front of the
right.
Yeah. So, okay, I'm glad we're addressing it.
Anything further? Have you made your motion? Further.
I have not. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 496 with a due pass recommendation to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hicks moves Senate Bill 496 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none. Motion carries. Representative Barnhart, will you carry the bill, please?
Yes, sir.
Close a work session on Senate Bill 496 and open a work session on Senate Bill 581.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 581 was also heard on June 3rd. It extends the sunset date from January 2nd, 2014 to January 2nd, 2016 for statutes authorizing declaration of county fiscal emergency, establishment of fiscal assistance board, and development of recovery plan when eligible counties unable to meet minimally adequate level of state required services. The measure declares an emergency effective upon passage. There is a no revenue impact. A fiscal impact was issued on the measure.
This is the bill I believe Representative Blively testified to that...
Representative Roblin.
Yeah, Senator Roblin. Wrong bill. Sorry. Which is ready to go. Mr. Vice Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 581 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Hicks moves Senate Bill 581 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? None, so ordered. Motion carries. Representative Barnhart, would you carry that bill?
Yes, if I can figure out what it is. I think it's simply a conflict.
Sorry, wrong. I don't think I meant to ask you.
That's just as well. It was fine with me, Mr. Chair.
No, it's meant to be Barnhart. He's on the bill.
I guess I did mean to ask you. Would you carry the bill?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
If my name is on it, I'd better carry it.
Yes.
We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 581.
Yeah.
Well, colleagues, we are not ready with paperwork on House Bill 2206 or with 3404, so we will postpone those. We're also going to need to wait for our paperwork on House Bill 3389, which we heard a moment ago.
And 3530.
So our business here is done for the day. Committee's adjourned.